Brother Ali, Chair, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, wassalamu alaikum, peace be with you. And thank you from the bottom of my heart for the welcome which you have afforded me, for the kind words with which you have introduced me, and for the comradeship which in just 48 hours in this city has made me fall in love with the city and its active cadre of people. I have seldom met so many progressive people from so many places on the earth in such a short time. And that was reflected in the extraordinary hors d'oeuvre which has just been placed before us. If I truly am, Chair, the main course, then no main course has ever been supported by such rich and beautiful appetizers. We toured the horizon. We conjured forth the spirit of great people. We quoted from their work and we declared that though their hearts may have stopped beating in their bodies, those hearts continue to beat in ours. And I was thinking when I was listening to the beautiful tributes to Iqbal, to Edward, to the people of Bolivia, to the people of Peru, to all the downtrodden in the world, of an incident which happened to me in 1999 when, with 11 of my comrades, we drove a red London bus, a 1963 Routemaster, traditional red London bus, all the way from Big Ben to Baghdad, across 12 countries, 3 continents, 15,000 kilometers, stopping for public meetings every evening, beginning with small rallies, ending in Baghdad with 3 million people on the streets to receive us. A symbol that though Britain was complicit and guilty of a great crime against the people of Iraq, that not all of the British people had that blood on their hands. And we stopped in a very small town in the dead of night at midnight, near to Oran in Algeria. And the townspeople had been waiting for 3 hours. It was a very old London bus. And they had waited for us in the dark for our arrival. And though tired, of course, I had to rouse myself to make yet another speech. And in the course of the speech, I quoted, as I often did, the great Argentine revolutionary Che Guevara. I said, international solidarity, said Guevara, is the love between the peoples. And after the meeting, a very old man waited to speak to me and he said, you know, Che Guevara spoke in this very town in 1963, when the now President Bouteflika was the Minister for Youth, and Guevara was touring the revolutions of the world, bringing the fraternal greetings of the Cuban Revolution. And the old man said, you quoting Che Guevara here in this small town this evening, almost 40 years after he himself spoke here, symbolizes the golden thread which connects all the people from all the time who love freedom and fight for liberation. And that's what we in this audience stand for this evening. Now I bring you the fraternal greetings of the great anti-war movement which has arisen in my country in its millions with the support of virtually every labor union in the country, with the support of members of parliament, people involved in political organizations of all kinds, but crucially, people who have never been involved in political organizations before, not the least of whom are the school students who, on the day that the barbarous assault on Iraq began, flooded in their thousands out of their classrooms and onto the streets and into the demonstrations, the biggest ever school strikes in the history of Britain, and who are a part of our great movement. And I stand here at the invitation of the Muslim Canadian Congress, conscious of the fact that one of the greatest strengths of the anti-war movement in Britain has been the unbreakable alliance between the progressive indigenous population of the country and the 2 million strong Muslim population of Great Britain. And it is a model which I commend everywhere, which seems already to be in operation here in Toronto, but still in many parts of the world, is a simple truth which has not yet been grasped, which is this: whatever our differences of ideology, theology, of which way to pray, which direction to bow, one thing unites us which is much greater than any of those differences, and it is our absolute rejection of injustice. Our absolute rejection of injustice. And I believe that our movement will continue to grow. Its form is still in spin. I myself, you know, I said at the beginning, comrades and friends, Willie Gallagher, the great Clydeside trade union leader and Britain's last communist MP, used to begin his meetings by saying, comrades and friends, and I hope by the end of the meeting, I don't have any friends left. That sometimes happens to me. That sometimes happens to me, though not in the way that Willie meant. He meant that by the end of the evening, everyone would be a comrade, everyone would be a member of the party. I myself can't say that, because I currently am in a way between parties. I didn't lose, Ali, my bed or my clothes or my house, not yet. But I have for 6 months lost my membership of the British Labour Party, which I have held for 36 years, since I was 13 years old, for the expression and for no other reason of my honestly held views and beliefs, principally in the famous Wolves interview on Abu Dhabi television late on a Saturday night in the middle of the war. I must say, had I known that the Labour leadership were such avid watchers of Abu Dhabi television on Saturday nights, I might have chosen my words more carefully. But I famously said that two of the leaders of the richest and most powerful countries in the world had fallen like wolves upon the wretched, virtually defenseless and long-suffering people of Iraq. And it has been suggested in the last few days that if only I were prepared to apologize, that my punishment on Wednesday of this coming week, when I face a show trial in Britain in 2003 for my beliefs as an elected member of Parliament, four times elected by the people of Glasgow, if I were prepared to apologize, then my punishment might be reprimand instead of expulsion. So I have here prepared an apology. I wish to apologize to the noble wolf, which does not deserve the comparison with those who fell upon the poor, benighted people of Iraq. And I tell you this, I'd rather be a wolf than a jackal or a jackass like the people who have brought the world to this state that we see it in today. I want to make it clear on this stage, as I will when I reach London on Tuesday morning, that I'm not prepared to apologize for telling the truth about Iraq and the war. I might be prepared to accept an apology from Tony Blair, but only if he in turn apologizes to the people of Britain, Iraq, and all the world for the disaster in which he has led humankind with this great crime, this great blunder in Iraq. I'm not here only to speak about Iraq. Indeed, I want to use the example of Iraq and others to illustrate a bigger truth, which I would like to illuminate in the beginning by quoting from the blessed St. Augustine, who wrote in his wonderful book, City of God, about an encounter between Alexander the Great and a pirate captain on the high seas. Ordering the pirate to halt, Alexander says, "How dare you terrorize these waters as a pirate?" And the captain answers, "How dare you terrorize the whole world? You, with your great navy, can call me a pirate and yourself an emperor and other men what you will. Isn't that the world that we are living in today? Where the emperors, self-appointed emperors, one of them elected by a vote, the other appointed by a group of judges after electoral fraud, eliminating hundreds of thousands of black people's votes, with all the legitimacy of Alexander, appointing themselves the emperors of the world, describing themselves as the international community, and arrogating unto themselves the right to call other men pirates. terrorists, rogue states, whom God has given, the blasphemy of it all, that God has given these two Anglo-Saxon men with their Bibles in one hand and their cruise missiles in the other, the right to go around the world setting fire to other people's countries, occupying their land, stealing their things, changing their regimes. It is a blasphemy. I heard them just the other day telling us to remember those heartbreaking messages left by those poor women on those aeroplanes on 9/11. Messages of farewell, messages of love left on the answering machines of their children and their husbands as they flew to their death. I heard these two war leaders wrapping themselves in the misery and suffering of those women as a justification for the slaughter in which they have been engaged. And I thought to myself, you know, just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and their loved ones don't have answering machines and many of them don't even have homes, it doesn't make the deaths of those Afghan women delivered from the sky any less obscene than the deaths of those American women on 9/11. But of course, these killers in sharp suits, though they might pay lip service to the idea that all humankind is equal, by their actions every day make clear that for them the blood of some is worth many times more than the blood of others. They are quite unmoved by the thousands of dead Afghans. They don't even want to count them, let alone know their names, still less organize state-sponsored remembrance services and moments of silence for them. These Afghans are merely collateral damage in the regime change they have brought about. And what a regime change it is. If you'll forgive me quoting myself, I told Margaret Thatcher across the chamber of the House of Commons the night before the so-called Mujahideen triumphed in Kabul, having been armed, financed, trained, and diplomatically supported by Ronald Reagan and her. I told her, "You have opened the gates to the barbarians, and a long dark night will now descend upon the people of Afghanistan." Bin Laden. They try to talk to us about Bin Laden. Who invented Bin Laden? Who armed Bin Laden? Who financed Bin Laden and pointed him in the direction of the people of Afghanistan? Reagan and Thatcher and imperialism. Bin Laden was their creature, not ours. They try to tell us about Saddam Hussein. They try to say that anyone who stood beside the 23 million people of Iraq, anyone who raised their voice against the killing of an Iraqi child every 6 minutes of every day and every night of 13 years by economic sanctions was somehow an apologist for Saddam Hussein. As long ago as the 1970s, I was a founder member of the Campaign Against Repression and for Democratic Rights in Iraq. I used to be demonstrating outside the Iraqi embassy in London for human rights and democracy when British ministers and businessmen were inside the embassy selling them guns and selling them gas. I had an interview this morning with CBC. Don't think the journalist fancied me much. He described me as having been a regular visitor at the court of Saddam Hussein. I told him I met Saddam Hussein twice, exactly the same number of times as Donald Rumsfeld met Saddam Hussein. The difference is that Donald Rumsfeld met him twice to sell him guns and to give him maps to show him where the Iranian army was so he could land chemical weapons on their heads. And I met him twice to try to stop the killing, to try to end the wars, to try to end the agony. That's the difference between me and Donald Rumsfeld. And it's this double standard which is the flaw at the heart of Western policy towards the East. It's the flaw at the heart, it's the cancer at the heart of relations between the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world today. It's the double standards which calls the small boy with a stone in his hand in Gaza a terrorist, and the butcher Sharon, described by the American president himself as a man of peace. It's that double standard. You know, even Sharon doesn't call himself a man of peace. Sharon must have looked at his friends and said, "This guy really is crazy. He thinks I'm a man of peace." It's the double standard that says the man with the small gun or the young woman who straps explosives to herself is a terrorist, while the man in the F-16 or the Apache helicopter gunship firing missiles is a legitimate combatant. As my friend Ahmed Ben Bella, the leader of the Algerian Revolution, which gave 1 million martyrs to be free of French colonial rule, said when taxed with the military tactics of the FLN. "Why," he said, the journalist in Paris, "why are you putting bombs in baby carriages?" Ben Bella answered, "If the French will give us some of their aeroplanes and some of their tanks, we'll give them the baby carriages. That's a trade we're prepared to make." It's the double standard which starved and massacred the people of Iraq under that siege, based on a lie, based on the lie that Iraq was bristling with rockets tipped with biological and chemical warheads, which at 45 minutes' notice, said Tony Blair, and I was there, closer than I am to you now in the front row, when he delivered it with that catch in his voice, that faux sincerity, sounding like the Reverend Jimmy Swaggart just before he was unmasked for sleeping with hookers and stealing the collection. I was there when he told us that within 45 minutes Iraq could land these deadly weapons on British bases on Cyprus. He never explained, by the way, why we've got British bases on Cyprus. Certainly not to defend Cyprus, as anyone who knows what happened to it almost 30 years ago will understand. It was a bright, shining lie. It's one of the biggest lies of all history, because 1 million children died because of that lie. Now they've been there 6 months, hundreds of thousands of them. You remember they told us, Iraq's so big, how can Hans Blix's few hundred inspectors be expected to find these weapons? Well, there are now 350,000 of them for 6 months occupying the entire country. They have virtually the whole Iraqi leadership under their lock and key, able to do with them as they will. Remember, they told us they had to get these Iraqi scientists out of the country so they could interrogate them without minders, so that they could force the information out of them. Well, every Iraqi scientist today currently lives under their guns. And you know what they've found? In all of that 6 months, they found one vial of Botox in a fridge. There's more Botox in Joan Collins's makeup bag than they've found in all of Iraq in all of these 6 months. But look at the double standard. 1 million Iraqi children have to die because Iraq is falsely accused of holding weapons of mass destruction, while Israel sits on top of a mountain of weapons of mass destruction. Chemical weapons, biological weapons, and as we know, thanks to the brave Jew Mordechai Vanunu, hundreds of nuclear weapons and the rockets to deliver them. When Vanunu went to court 3 years ago to try to end the long years of solitary confinement, they wired up his jaw like Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs so that he couldn't speak out loud in the courtroom and tell us about Israel's weapons of mass destruction. Has anybody ever threatened sanctions against Israel because of its weapons of mass destruction? Anybody ever threatened to bomb, besiege, invade Israel because of its weapons of mass destruction? The only sanction we've ever placed on Israel is to force them to participate in the Eurovision Song Contest when they're not even in Europe. The very idea of threatening such things against Israel is funny, because we know it could never happen. Yet what has the nightmare of the people of Iraq been for the last 13 years but a brazen example of these double standards? They said that Iraq had to be starved and besieged because of the inviolability of United Nations Security Council resolutions. You know, you laugh or cry, I don't know which. Israel has broken more United Nations Security Council resolutions than all other countries in the world put together. All other countries put together. What about the people of Kashmir, who have waited almost 60 years, not for anything that they could only dream of, not for any great revolutionary change, no, for the right to vote in a plebiscite to decide how they want to be governed. For almost 60 years, that Security Council resolution, passed unanimously, has been left to rot on the shelves of the United Nations, like the millions of Kashmiris living under the occupation of 600,000 Indian soldiers, now advised by the Israeli Secret Service Mossad, a new relationship cemented by the visit to India, an obscene visit to India, an insult to the memory of Nehru and Gandhi and the founders of the country, by the brute murderer General Ariel Sharon to New Delhi just a few weeks ago. United Nations resolutions. A year ago, past Easter, when Sharon's army was rampaging through the Palestinian territories, when the Church of the Nativity, the birthplace of Jesus Christ, was in flames, and priests and nuns lay dead, unburied on the crypt, when the refugee camp of Jenin found their little square mile of rancid, rat-infested refugee camp, which they've lived in for 50 years, from which on a clear day from the rooftops you can see the shining city of Haifa on the coast, from which these refugees were driven. They can see their own houses, their own orchards, their own trees being picked by foreigners from Brooklyn, from Toronto, from London. This little refugee camp was invaded by thousands of Israeli soldiers from air, land, and sea in the massacre of Jenin, which I visited just days after its end, and still keep the dust of that camp on my boots. When the United Nations Security Council convened on a Saturday night, they unanimously agreed to send a team of inspectors to check reports of mass destruction of the refugees in the camp in Jenin. And General Sharon told them to get stuffed. There would be no UN inspectors coming here. And you know what? They promptly got stuffed, and nobody said a word about it ever since. That's the double standard. That's what the so-called international community mean to the masses in the world on the wrong end of the double standards in Palestine, in Iraq, in Kashmir, in Afghanistan, around the globe, where these self-appointed emperors with their big sticks are dealing out their version of justice. And in those circumstances, is anybody surprised that people strike back? Is anybody surprised that, however distorted or grotesque the form or even the content of that resistance, that all around the world, hundreds of millions of people rage against that injustice? And amongst those hundreds of millions, tens of millions are ready to support armed struggle against us. And from amongst those tens of millions, that millions are prepared to take up those arms against us. That's why I say Bush and Blair and Chrétien, let's not exculpate the Canadian leadership from this. They might not be in Baghdad, but they're in Kabul. And they might be in Tehran. They might be in Damascus the next time the bugle blows. These leaders are not just guilty of a crime, but as the French statesman Talleyrand once said when told of the murder of an opponent by his aide, who said, "It's a terrible crime." Talleyrand said, "Yes, it's a terrible crime, but it's worse than a crime, it's a blunder." These leaders are guilty of a crime, yes, but also a blunder against the interests of our own country and of our own people. In Britain today, in the mother of parliaments, you know, you used to be able to go up Downing Street and stand outside number 10 and get your picture taken. I did it as a child. It's the closest I ever got to 10 Downing Street. Now the British Parliament is ringed with steel by policemen with machine guns, inside as well as outside the Parliament. Even the cafeterias of the Houses of Parliament are patrolled by men with machine guns, and no one may approach any British government building. In such fear are they that this rage against us will strike them in their lair. Our ancient freedoms, our civil liberties, are being shredded and discarded in front of our eyes. Such is their fear of the other. Such is their fear of Johnny Foreigner. As I look out at this audience today, I tell you, most of you wouldn't last 5 minutes. If you walked down Whitehall, the police would be stopping you at every turn, asking who you were and what your business was. We're about to introduce identity cards, which we've never had, so that anyone with a beard or a dark face or who looks other can be stopped and criminalized. Our prisons, like Belmarsh, have people entombed in their dungeons without charge, without trial, without legal representation, and without any prospect of any of these things. Our citizens are languishing in Guantanamo Bay as legal non-persons, subject to no jurisdiction at all, in territory seized from Cuba by the United States, and the British government have not lifted a finger to help them. And there are citizens from many lands there, in that netherworld, that demi-monde, which is Guantanamo. And I've searched the Canadian papers in the last 2 days, back to front, front to back. I can't find a reference to any of these things which are happening here in Canada, if anything, on even a bigger scale than they are happening in Britain. In our country, they're building prison camps with barbed wire, patrolled by German shepherd dogs and men with guns, to hold not criminals, but people who've arrived on our shores and committed the crime of thinking they had arrived in a free country which might give them safe haven. These are all the other side of the coin of aggression abroad, war on civil liberties and minorities at home. These are two sides of the same coin. And if we won't stand up for the people overseas who are on the receiving end of these emperors' idea of justice, at least stand up for our own freedoms and liberties here before they're gone, never to return. Now, our anti-war movement continues for a whole variety of reasons, some of which are obvious: to stop the occupations of Afghanistan, Palestine and Iraq, where the Iraqi resistance, as we predicted they would, are taking a terrible toll of young American and British lives, who in turn have taken a terrible toll of Iraqi lives, young and old. We predicted to them that the idea that the Iraqis, uniquely of all the peoples of the world, would welcome hundreds of thousands of foreign soldiers invading their country, kicking down the doors of their houses, invading the privacy of their women, dragging their young men out into the street, their hands tied behind their backs, their faces down in the dust, taking them off to concentration camps, turning the country into a shawarma for the enrichment of George Bush's corporate friends. The idea that Iraqis would welcome such a thing was a racist fantasy and would quickly be disproved. And that is exactly what is happening today. We exist to oppose the next wars, because make no mistake about it, if they can, they will spread these wars elsewhere. Syria, Iran, most importantly of all. Cuba has now moved up the axis of evil in the last couple of weeks. As the election looms, the rhetoric is ratcheted up. Threats against American citizens from the Bush administration, implied threats against Canada and Mexico for its role in trading and investing in Cuba, North Korea. The war can spread at any moment. Anybody who thinks that because they're in trouble in Iraq, they can't spread the war, has forgotten the lesson of Vietnam. The more trouble they got into in Vietnam, the more they escalated and spread the war, as the people of Cambodia and Laos can still today testify. Don't believe that there's now no danger of more wars, more invasion. And we must keep our movement together for that too. But lastly, we exist for another reason, and which I know not everyone here is a socialist and may not agree, but I believe it's important to say that these wars don't come out of thin air. They don't even come out of the fact that the two war parties are led by such belligerent, born-again, pseudo-Christians like Bush and Blair, who see some white man's burden out there that only they have the moral fiber to pick up and shoulder. No. The prevailing economic and political system which governs the world is the reason for the wars. These wars flow ineluctably from the system of capitalism and imperialism which rules the world, which requires the subjugation of markets, the enslavement of peoples, the capturing of the sources of raw materials which make their empire run. And until we change that prevailing economic and political order in the world, our children and their children yet unborn will be gathering in halls like this to oppose war without end. And I want to close, for I fear I've taxed your patience. Because I'm in a theater with a concept which came to me as I sat down on these red theater seats today. It harks back to the great story by the American communist Howard Fast, made into Stanley Kubrick's wonderful movie, Spartacus. The story of the great slave revolt which shook the Empire of Rome to its foundation. And at the end of the film, when the brave slave army has been defeated and only a few hundred of them remain alive, the empire comes to the battlefield and says to the survivors, "You may all go free. All we require of you is that you identify the slave Spartacus." And just as Spartacus is about to rise to save the lives of his comrades, one after another of them rise and say, "I am Spartacus. I am Spartacus. I am Spartacus." And in that spirit, in this theater, tonight we declare, "I am a Palestinian. I am an Afghan. I am an Iraqi." Thank you very much.